From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio. Focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour. As I like to say when we start the show, this is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. And we're glad to have Aliza. Did I say that correctly?
Yes, you did.
Aliza, half of Elizabeth, you told me.
Yes.
Aliza Kobos joins us. And you are the new director of Project Rachel. Is relatively new?
Very new.
Very new.
This would be my first year.
Very good.
As a coordinator.
Very good.
So I'm still kind of nervous and trying to take over for Paula.
Yeah.
Who left huge shoes to.
Big shoes. Did they measure your foot? Did they
no, I
see
think,
if it fits?
I don't think they would have given it to me if they would have.
Well, I'm sure you're going to do very well.
I pray so.
Yeah, well, we pray with you. So.
Thank you.
There's a lot of prayer in this building.
Yes,
indeed. So tell us a little bit about yourself. You live in Fairfield.
I live in Fairfield. I was born and raised in Fairfield. Mm-hmm. And so...
did you go to Fairfield High School, Armio?
I went to Armio.
Armio, yeah.
For 2 days. And then I moved to San Rafael.
Oh, okay.
In Marin County. So yeah. I did my high school in San Rafael.
Which high school did you go to?
San Rafael High School.
San Rafael High School.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been married for 28 years.
Wow.
I have 4 children.
Wow.
3 grandchildren. And I'm here now as the new coordinator for Rachel's Vineyard.
Where are you close to? I mean, are you close physically to the grandchildren? Or are they in the same area?
Well, the youngest one, who's 2 months old, lives with me. And the 2 girls live in San Jose.
Oh, so pretty close.
Yeah.
I have some grandkids in Redwood City.
Oh, okay.
And a couple in Davis. So,
nice.
Yeah. They're, my mom used to tell me the grandkids are God's gift for growing old.
I'm so in love with them.
Isn't it funny? You get to do all that over again. And then somebody says, and then they go home. But I don't want them to go home. I want them to stay. You know, it's just wonderful.
I can't. I don't know. Everyone says, is it true that you love the grandchildren more than your own children? I don't know what to answer sometimes.
Well, you just say love doesn't have a number on it.
It's a different kind. I just, you know, when my first granddaughter was born, I was just so in love with her.
Yeah. I saw it in my mom. I thought, of course, I can't remember back to when I was that young, but with my kids, holy cow. It was like, whoa, she really loves those kids.
Right.
And you know, the thing that I found too, as the kids got a little bit older, you're trying to raise your kids right and teach them right from wrong and do all those things, and they step in the pothole every now and then. But boy, if grandma told them to do something, they did it.
Right.
You know, there was just this real respect for, you know, if Graham says you're going to Mass on Sunday, you're going. You know, it's different.
It was hard for me because I didn't grow up with either one of my mm-hmm. grandparents. They passed before I was born, so
right.
I didn't have the chance. So I want to do the best of being a good grandma to my grandchildren. So.
Well, I'm sure you're doing that.
I'm a little spoiled.
I can see it in your eyes. Yeah.
Yes.
So you've worked in the pro-life arena before, though, or volunteered.
I was a volunteer for the 40 Days for Life. Mm-hmm. So I had been doing that for 10 years.
Right.
We would go out to the prayer
in
sites.
In Fairfield?
Yes.
Yeah.
To the right outside Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got started.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a huge change in my life, because that's what, you know, led me to going to my own retreat.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever knew about my abortion. So, mm-hmm. you know, it was kind of hard being there praying and feeling like a hypocrite, kind of,
mm-hmm.
you
mm-hmm.
know, because I couldn't tell them that I was there for a reason.
Right, right.
But it was life-changing. And I thank God every day, because I mean, it was him that put me on that path to my, I feel like my salvation, because I was so lost. I was very lost.
So did you go through the Project Rachel as well?
I did. 6 years after I started the 40 Days for Life, they invited us to the Life Ministries, and Paula was there.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And so they were talking, they had a couple who was talking about their abortion and how they had gone to a retreat. And at the end of their speech, we had to take a little break. And I went and I found Paula, who was just standing there. Yeah. And I just told her, I said, you know, it's been 25 years and I've never told anybody about my situation. Mm-hmm. She just hugged me, and I felt it was like God's mercy saying it was time for me to start my healing process. So
was it hard to take that step?
Very hard.
Yeah.
Very, very hard. Just, she told me, she said, you know, would you like to come to retreat? And my husband was there with me, and I hadn't talked to my husband about my abortion yet, so it was kind of hard.
That's a lot of courage.
Yes, it was just gut-wrenching. I didn't know whether to say yes or no. He didn't know why I was crying. So once we got home, we went to the church parking lot, and I said, I have to tell you about something that I did when I was younger. And I was really afraid because he was one of those persons when we were at the prayer site who was very hard. Oh, these women are going to, you know, he would be really mean about it. So I was very afraid of what he was going to say when I told him about my situation. So he just hugged me and we cried for about an hour, hour and a half. And he told me that he would support me on going to retreat. So even then, trying to get ready for my retreat, it was really hard. It was like, I'm not worthy, or, you know, just having second thoughts.
Right.
But Paula would call me at least once a week before retreat. Said, are you having second thoughts? Yes, I am. I would answer, I am. She's like, yeah, that's why I'm calling you, because, you know, a lot of people have second thoughts. We just want to make sure you get over that and show up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was really hard.
So it's a Friday afternoon through Sunday.
Yes.
up in Auburn.
Yes.
At the Mercy Center. Just describe what's, I know we hear from people who are hesitant, would like to do it, but they're hesitant about getting into a group or what it, the unknown, I guess.
Well, I can't tell you too much about what happens, but we get there around noon. It right. starts at 1 o'clock.
Yeah, and then that's very important. It's very confidential.
Yes.
There's no names. There's nobody knows anything about right. anything. Yeah,
we absolutely. Have to sign papers, and even the participants have to sign papers
right.
because they're going to listen to everybody else's
sure.
story, so
sure.
they can't, you know,
go out in the community
right,
and, yeah.
and talk about it. It starts at exactly at 1 o'clock. We go and we do our prayers for everybody. We introduce ourselves as the group and the participants. And just, you could feel it right away. A lot of the women come in so much pain and embarrassed, and, you know, they've been carrying that for years, just like I did. And just the mercy starts showing up because everybody starts crying and talking about it. And we go the first day till like 10 o'clock.
Wow.
Yeah. Then the next morning we start at 7 and we end around 11:30. So it's a lot of work.
Wow.
It's a lot of work, but it's beautiful. And then on Sunday we have a mass in honor of our children, and we name them, and we write a letter for them explaining why we did what what we did and, you know, what led us to it. And we asked for forgiveness. And it's beautiful. And just the place, the Mercy Center, wow, it's such a beautiful place.
Yeah.
I think it's the perfect place to mm-hmm. to have the retreat.
Does it help that there are other people there in the same situation? I know every story is unique, truly, and every person's unique. But does it help that other people are in a similar, they're there for the same reason?
Yes.
Or does it make it harder?
I think it's just the initial starting to talk about it, because we have to talk about our situation and why we got to where we are. And nobody wants to be the first person.
Right.
But once the first person starts talking about it and, you know, sharing their story, it makes it a little bit easier for everybody else to just kind of go and talk about their story as well.
Do you say, Lord, don't make me the first one to talk?
I think I was, when I went to my retreat, I think I was the first one. I was like, okay, I'll go first. Because nobody really wants to.
Sure.
Yeah, it's really hard. It's scary. And you think people that are there are going to judge you. But I've still have a couple of ladies that went to retreat when I went, and we still.
Oh, good.
We still communicate with each other.
Oh, that's
and we
wonderful.
See each other once in a while. So.
Is there an after? You know, is there follow up? Is it?
Well, after the retreat is over, we have a meeting to see how everybody's doing 6 weeks after a retreat. So we have a follow-up. And we stay in contact. I have a lot of the participants who call me, or, you know, they'll text me. I get Christmas cards mm-hmm. or birthday cards, and it's really nice. It's been, to me, it's been really nice to know that I've been part of somebody else's healing mm-hmm. and that my story has helped other people come to retreat now.
So now you're going to be running the retreat.
Yes.
Do you get together? I know you're new, but afterwards and say, you know, do we need to tweak this? Do we need to do something different? Did this not, I don't know, work, if that's the right word, but do you evaluate, you know, did we reach the people we needed to reach in the way that they needed to be reached?
We do. As a team, we, before we go home, we get together and mm-hmm. we're like, well, you know, this person I didn't think was going to let go, but,
right.
you know, and we evaluate and we fill out forms of who we might need to get in contact with mm-hmm. and make sure that they're doing okay. And, well, we have the facilitators and the therapist. And a lot of the participants talk to the therapist after a retreat as mm-hmm. well.
The one story I hear consistently from people who have had an abortion, who regret it, is, I can't forgive myself. I can't believe God will forgive me, even though God, don't underestimate God. You must hear that a lot.
It's the hardest, I think, it's the hardest part for all of us to forgive ourselves. Like, for example, before I went to my retreat, I think I went to confession like 7 or 8 times to confess the same sin mm-hmm, because, mm-hmm. and it's not that, you know, I felt like God didn't forgive me, but it was just me that could not mm-hmm. get over it, because I could not believe that, you know, I had done something like that, and it was the hardest thing to forgive myself. But in retreat, it's a beautiful thing.
You know, I've spent a lot of time over the years thinking about this issue and mm-hmm. and how divided the country is on it
mm-hmm.
and what's and frequently you see that there just doesn't appear to be very little movement on it, you know, like you've got people on this side feel this way and the people on this side feel this way, and I've been really impressed with the more recent attempts, as Bishop Soto says, to accompany women who are in need, to and all the programs like the Sacramento Life Center, the Mother Teresa Maternity Home in Placerville, right. the Bishop Agagos Maternity Home here, the Gabriel Project, all those things right. to not moralize at anybody, just to help people right. in need, and maybe just that hand. The other thing I hear from people is that I felt all alone in making this decision. I felt like I wasn't going to have a friend in the world. It was just easier to be done with it. And I think that reaching out.
I can honestly say that if somebody would have said something to me, mm-hmm. I would have never been in that situation yep. ever.
Yeah.
Like when I had my abortion, I had never seen a picture of what an abortion was or what they do.
Right.
I knew I was pregnant. I knew that I went into that clinic. When I came out, I knew I wasn't pregnant anymore, but I did not know what had happened.
Right.
Or, you know, how big the baby was or anything. And I do believe that if I would have seen a picture or something,
an ultrasound.
I would have never been in that situation.
Yeah, I know as a man, the male ego, mm-hmm. The first time I saw an ultrasound and the doctor or the technician, whoever it was, says, "That's the heartbeat." I just spontaneously started crying. You know, and I thought, wow, if I had been in that position, unfortunately wasn't, by the grace of God, I don't take any pats on the back, you know, mm-hmm. but if I had been in that position, which I could have been easily, that would have stopped me in my track, the ultrasound, I think.
Right.
You know, it really would have. It would have been easier to just, if you were ambivalent, or especially for a man, you know,
right.
I'll just drop you off at the clinic, I'm going to go play golf, you know, and I'll pick you up in a couple hours or whatever it is.
Exactly.
Give me a call. It's a lot easier, but if you're accompanying and you see that ultrasound, it's very difficult.
Well, when the abortion's going to happen, they don't let anybody come in there with you.
Right.
I was by myself in a little room, and the nurse that was prepping me was so cold.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sitting there and like shivering because the room was extremely cold. And then the coldness of the people that worked there made it even worse. And I guess I just wanted to get it over with so I could get out of that place.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's not a joyful time.
It's not.
And the people involved, they know what it is. You didn't,
mm-hmm.
but they did, you know. And they're. I can't imagine any joy in a room like that.
There's none. I mean, it's just the walls. There's no pictures. Well, at least where I went, there was no pictures that said absolutely nothing about anything.
Right.
It was just the table and the machine, where I'm sure that the doctor is watching what he's doing, and the other machine where they're doing the suction. They put me completely to sleep, so I don't remember mm-hmm. absolutely anything. I just remember waking up, and the nurse came and made sure that I was okay. They gave me some orange juice and a cookie, like when you go and donate blood.
You donate blood, yep.
And they let me sit there for a good half hour, and then they send me on my way out. And that
did you regret it right away?
I cried. I cried and I cried, and I didn't know why there was so much sorrow. And of course, I didn't think it was going to be a happy moment.
Right.
But just the hurt that I felt, and I cried for a few days, and I went home and my mother would ask me, what's wrong? I said, I don't know. I don't feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, what's wrong? I said, I don't know. I'm just bleeding a lot. I guess it's my period and I'm in a lot of pain. She made me teas and stuff like that to help me with the pain. But it wasn't this pain. It was
in your heart.
In my heart.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand it until I started on the pro-life movement. And then I went to pick up my daughters from high school one day. And there was a little group of pro-life people outside the school, like, passing out brochures and stuff. And I asked my daughter, I said, what's going on? It's like, oh, it's some people that are telling us to say no to abortion. Mm-hmm. And they have, like, pictures of what an abortion is. And I said, oh, okay. I said, well, what's that picture that they have? He's like, oh, that's what an abortion is. Had never seen it. So I wanted to be nosy, and I drove closer to it. And the sign at the bottom said, this is what abortion is.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the baby's face that was chopped into pieces, and the little hands and the arms. And that was the day that I felt that they took that bandage off my eyes and off my soul, and I knew what I had done.
Mm-hmm.
And I started crying. I just automatically started crying. I couldn't even drive because I was crying so much. And my daughters were asking, what's wrong? And I said, that is so sad. I couldn't tell them.
Sure.
You know, and after that was the first year that I started on the 40 Days for Life. Because finally my bandage had come off, and I had hidden it so deep in there that, you know, there was times that I would remember about my abortion, but it was such a shameful part of my life that I just wanted to hide it.
Yeah. So, and here you are today.
Here I am.
So, your plan, tell us, there's one coming up this fall?
Yes, there's
and that will be in Spanish.
The Spanish retreat, mm-hmm. Yes, and that is November 19th through the 21st.
Okay.
And then we have an English one. And that is in February, and that's February 4th through the 6th.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's always a Friday through Sunday.
Yes, yeah. It's always a weekend. And we always do ask the ladies or the people that come to retreat to take Monday off.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure.
It's a very, very hardworking weekend, and all the emotional stuff that they're going to go through takes a toll on your body, on your spirit.
So can couples go?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the year before that was the very first time that we had couples in the Spanish retreat. We had three couples, and it was different for me to see the side of the men. Because, you know, for 4 years we had done it and there was no men at retreat.
Right.
And this year there was one in particular. And all I wanted to do was, like, hug him and, you know, tell him that it was going to be okay. It wasn't an abortion. It was they lost their baby. The girl was pregnant. She was 7 months pregnant. And she went to her appointment, and the baby had already died in her stomach. So they had to make her go through the whole process of delivery.
Because of how far along she was.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And so it was really hard on both of them.
Yeah.
And it was so hard to see the side of the man, because I had never seen it. It was just how he was trying to comfort her the whole time, but he wasn't taking time to process his loss.
Right.
And the other two gentlemen were, like, it was just amazing.
Do they come as couples or do some men come alone?
We've never had any men just come by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this was the very first time that I had seen any men come to retreat.
Men seem to be the missing link in all this.
Yes.
In that, people say, well, why don't men just be more responsible? And that's a good thing. But what I'd rather than them being responsible, I'd rather them realize what a joy a child is. And of course, even if they don't want a child, to certainly respect the humanity of a child.
Well, the sad part about being responsible, they think they're being responsible by paying for the abortion.
Well, society has convinced them of that. Like, this is the responsible thing to do. We practice safe sex, and that failed for some reason. And now we have this child, and so it wasn't our fault.
Right.
And so the responsible thing to do, you know, the world's overpopulated and on and on and on and on, and on, you know.
It's sad that's the type of responsibility that they take.
Yeah. Well, it'd be nice if more men just knew about the joys of fatherhood.
Right. It's a beautiful thing.
It's the best thing that ever happened to me.
And then if they can, you know, experience fatherhood and then grandchildren come along, and
yeah.
It's the best.
Yeah.
Right.
And if you're lucky, great-grandchildren.
Right.
Not there yet.
Not there yet.
Yeah.
Right.
So your job title is with Project Rachel?
It's new coordinator for the Rachel's Vineyard.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So beyond the retreats, there's outreach. There's Project Rachel, and then the retreats as well. The Rachel's Vineyard.
Right.
Right.
And then once the retreat is over, you can see the therapist for as long as you need to, and there's no cost.
Right.
For as long as you want to keep seeing the therapist.
Oh, that's very good.
Mm-hmm.
That's very good.
Yeah.
And there is a cost to the retreat, but if people can't afford it, there's scholarships available.
The cost is $225 per person.
It's meals and everything.
That includes everything, the room,
right?
Meals and everything that comes with the retreat. But you know, if they can't afford it, they have to make some kind of donation at least, and then we pay for the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. Good. How can people sign up?
They can call me at Elisa Cobos, 707-863-2987, and leave me a message, and I will get back as soon as I'm able. And then there is the Project Rachel at scd.org.
Mm-hmm.
They can go on there as well.
SCD is Sacramento Catholic Diocese,
yes.
So it's easy to remember. Just about you can find just about anything there except how to order a pizza, I think.
Exactly.
So, and maybe even that. I'm not sure. Maybe we should put that on there.
A slice of pizza. Yeah. So they could just go on the website for the diocese, and they can find it.
Very good. Is there anything yet? I didn't ask you that you wanted to say today?
No, I think we covered the registration, which was the kind of important, and the sooner the better.
Yeah.
Because...
if you've been waiting for a sign, make this the sign.
Yes, you won't regret it. It's the healing process. It's a little hurtful, but it's just something that we have to go through. Once you're there, it's going to be the most beautiful experience because you can definitely feel the mercy of God working on us.
And you'd be surrounded by good, loving people.
Yes, and the place is beautiful.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily have to be Catholic.
No, you can have any denomination, and we welcome everybody.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
Elisa, a pleasure to meet you.
Nice meeting you. Thank you for having me.
Our prayers go with you.
Thank you.
And a lot of good prayers from our listeners, too.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Great.
We'll take a quick break. We'll be back with more on the Bishop's Hour right after this. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour.
Hello, this is Moises De Leon from the Office of Family and Respect Life. You're listening to Bishop's Hour with Bob Dunnan.
Thank you, Moises, for that wonderful introduction. Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining us today on the Bishop's Hour. We're pleased to welcome in Rabbi Seth Kesselman, who is the director of the Exodus Project. Seth, good day to you.
Good day to you, Bob. Always nice to hear your voice.
Nice to hear your voice, too. I'm sorry it's not in person, but we're back into virtual reality here.
Tough
times. How has, just before we launch into, I know a lot of people maybe haven't heard of the project, and we'll give them a thumbnail of that. How has COVID affected the Exodus Project?
So we serve people that are in prison and jail and coming out, and people are still in jail and still in prison and still coming out, so we've continued on through COVID. Early on in the pandemic, there was a whole bunch of early releases, so there were a lot of people that needed help, and there was very little employment. Now employment has picked up quite a bit, so we're much more successful at finding people jobs. We do a lot of mentoring, and for a while, mentors didn't necessarily want to meet in person or drive their mentees around or to appointments or that sort of things. But as the pandemic has ebbed, the mentoring has picked back up again. We have four houses now running for interim housing for people when they first get out who are homeless or otherwise homeless, and that's all going well.
So these... you said a number of people were, it was early release because of COVID?
Because of COVID, either because people got COVID inside or they were at high risk. Mm-hmm. They were doing a lot of early releases, six, 9 months ago.
Do we know, are people being adequately protected in the prison setting from COVID?
There really is no way to adequately protect either inmates or guards inside the prison system. I mean, it's not set up for that.
Right.
Everybody's all crammed in together and eating together and living together. So there really is no way to adequately protect people. So the simple answer is no.
Yeah, yeah. So the Exodus Project, talk about the genesis of the Exodus Project.
Exodus Project came into manifestation 2.5 years ago, but it was long before that a vision of Bishop Soto, who saw the good work that the diocese was doing with work inside the jails and prisons in
just
the diocese.
Basic prison ministry.
basic prison ministry from a Catholic perspective,
mm-hmm.
exactly. And that's been growing over the last 5-10 years and has become quite robust for the 25 or 30,000 people who are incarcerated in the span of the diocese. But people started to realize, including the bishop himself, that in some ways the most precious and the most important moment in terms of helping people is when they reach the gate and how to assist people with their return to their community. So there was a group of people that the bishop put together, Rich Fowler, who used to be the bishop's liaison and in charge of the detention ministry, put together a group that I was on to help develop this idea of a reentry program. And what came out of it was Exodus Project, an interfaith reentry program working with men and women, primarily in Sac County, who were coming out of Sac County Jail and to some extent coming out of state and federal prison as well.
So was you mentioned ecumenical or interfaith. Talk about that element of it.
Right. So faith is a significant component for a lot of our mentors who do one-to-one mentoring with the participants. We take mentors of all faiths, but we have a lot of Catholic mentors. We take participants of all faiths. We take participants who don't identify with any faith tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And for some of the mentees, they're interested in the faith element, and there might be Bible study, there might be going to church or mosque or synagogue with the mentor, or helping the mentor, helping them reconnect to a faith community. For others, it might be reading, it might be books that they discuss. And for others, that's not of interest, and we serve them as well with more of the social services component. So there is a faith element when there's an interest, but we're not pushing it.
So absent the Exodus Project, explain, I don't know, there's no such thing as the average inmate, but somebody is due to be released from the
right.
Sacramento County Jail, Yolo County Jail, et cetera, Solano County Jail. Due to be released, I heard something about 2 a.m. Is that accurate?
So unfortunately, there's still a lot of middle-of-the-night releases that can be anywhere from midnight to 5 a.m.
Hmm.
They're supposedly doing fewer and fewer of them, but it still definitely happens. Although we're able for our clients to be able to arrange for them to be released at a more decent hour and for one of us to go pick them up if that's what they require. In terms of the incarceration in Sacramento area, while we hear a lot about opioids, methamphetamines is still by far the drug of choice.
Mm-hmm.
And the vast majority of people incarcerated at the county jail, it's somehow related to, certainly almost all, you know, the vast majority, it's related to addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them is DUIs or alcohol, some of them
mm-hmm.
is opioids, but the majority of them, it's crystal meth. And it could be a direct drug charge, or it could be a theft, or something else that was drug-related. And a lot of them coming out, 70% of the ones that have been there for 6 months or longer, don't have stable housing when they return, and don't have a job when they come out. So they're really in need of support to try to reestablish their lives in their communities.
Two-part question. Are drugs available in the prison to feed their habit, and or are there addiction programs within, a county jail to help them kick that?
Good questions. Yeah, sure. So without COVID, there is AA and NA in the jail and in prisons. It was stopped for a while, and it's just started back up again in Sac County, at least. The NA and the AA programs are just starting to come back in. They were all put on hold for COVID. There is, unfortunately, some access, more in prison, but some in jail. But the majority of the people we work with, I think, are sincerely sober while they're incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
It's, of course, much harder to be sober once you're back on the street and your old drinking and using buddies are around. And,
sure.
You know, if you want it, it's gonna present itself to you.
Much
easier.
If some of your associates are contributed to you being incarcerated, and they're the one you call at 2 a.m. to come get a ride,
exactly,
that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, yeah. Or they're the ones that will give you a place
to stay,
to crash on. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So how do you break that cycle?
Well, so part of it is about us providing some housing, some interim housing in a hotel or in one of the houses that we have established in the community. Three of them we have set up with Saks Self-Help Housing and one we run on our own. And putting them in a sober living environment is a big piece of it. And then getting them employment so that they have time that they're spending, not just sitting around. Addiction boredom is the nemesis of people struggling with addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Opportunity and boredom together will spell.
I've never disaster. Heard it put that way, but it sure makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So we the mentors play a significant role in this. We have some 40 mentors now. We have a new mentor training coming up in August, where hopefully we'll train another 10 or 15 mentors, men and women from the community, perhaps listeners of yours, who are interested in helping by having a one-on-one relationship for perhaps a month or two or three or four while they're incarcerated, visits, and then for up to six months post-release.
Describe who you're looking for in a mentor.
So we're looking for people who are good communicators, who have good boundaries, but that we also do trainings in communication and boundaries. We have an expansive 18-hour training that we put everybody through. Some of our best mentors are in recovery themselves. Some of them are returning citizens themselves, but your average parishioner could also be a great mentor. There needs to be compassion. There needs to be the ability to listen. I like to say that some amount of personal brokenness in our own lives helps us to relate to the brokenness that people are going through coming out of jail. So being able to sort of access your own suffering mm-hmm. can actually enable you to be there for somebody else's suffering.
What percent of the mentors you have been incarcerated themselves?
Currently, it's probably about 15%.
Mm-hmm. 15, 1-5.
1-5, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So not a large percentage.
Not as many as we'd like, mm-hmm. but we have some good ones who have been incarcerated. We've got some great ones that have not been incarcerated. Yeah.
And I know we're early, and it's hard to judge a program. In the very early stages. I mean, I don't know when it's not early. Even 20 years sounds early and with a lot of things. But can you assess a success rate at this point?
For the people that stick with our program, the success is quite high.
Mm-hmm.
Especially at the beginning, had a lot of people who were talking a good game and really interested in it while they were inside. And then when they got out, sort of just went a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them went in a successful direction and didn't want something that affiliated that sort of
right.
was connected to
right.
their incarceration. And others went back down on a difficult path and sort of left us, you know, didn't stay connected. But the ones that do stay connected, we have a pretty good success rate of getting them back on track. Occasionally, people will relapse a bit, or maybe they get picked up by probation for a relapse and go back in for a week and then come back out again and continue with our program. We try to stick with people even when they, or if they relapse, and then they come to us and say, I had a tough weekend, and we say, well, I'm sure it was hard to come and tell me that today. How are we going to start again from today with day one of recovery?
What's the biggest element? Is it employment? Is it housing? Is it a human connection? What's the biggest part, or is it just a whole bunch of pieces to the puzzle?
I think you named three of the biggest ones. Yes, employment and housing are huge. Recovery is probably, you know, number one, but it's hard to be sober when you're literally living on the street. And human connection plays through the whole thing, and we try to offer that as best we can. So it's definitely multifaceted.
Are most of these people single, or do they have families to go back to?
A lot of them are single. A lot of them have spouses. A lot of them have kids. The majority of them probably have kids.
Uh-huh.
We work with both men and women. Sometimes their kids have been taken to by Child Protective Services, sure. and they're trying to get them back.
Right.
As they get their life back together, it's a pretty wide range of people. I mean, crime, they say, is a young man's game, mm-hmm. but we have clients that are in their 60s.
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Finding them. Well, first off, housing. I know from experience with homeless housing that frequently you try to establish a homeless shelter, if you will. You get a lot of neighborhood opposition.
Right.
How do you
right.
pull that off with somebody who's been incarcerated? I can imagine even more neighborhood
even
opposition.
More, right. So SAC Self-Help Housing helps us set up these houses that will house 4 or 5 or 6 of our clients and in a house with a house leader. And because it's under a certain number of people, it doesn't actually need a huge amount of zoning or guide. Or
doesn't have to go before the council and everybody gets along.
Doesn't have to go through the council.
Right.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
Because they're small, scattered site houses. So that's kind of the model. And then they're just living in a neighborhood, minding their own business, doing good work, taking the bus to work,
mm-hmm.
Taking the light rail or driving their car, or a couple of our mentors get them bicycles, and we take bicycle donations too, and one of our mentors fixes them up, and we give bikes to quite a number of our clients as well, so that they're able to bike to the light rail and then take the light rail to work and all of that. So we haven't hit too much of a roadblock with neighbors.
Oh,
but we've
good.
Also knock on, you know, God, thank God we've had pretty successful.
Right. Can I have the mentor's name that fixes bicycles? We have 4 teenagers, and it's like, well, why don't you ride your bike? Oh, well, it's got a flat tire. It's got the, you know, there's always
right.
a reason.
Right.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So with jobs. I remember years ago meeting a man. He was in the foot care business. You know, I mean, he sold shoes, but he sold orthotics and all that. And he took me to his store one time, and he said, "I make a point of hiring ex-cons, if you will." You know, and they were working in the back shop, and he said that's.
Yeah.
One of the basic, he didn't say it was a commandment, but that's one of the things Jesus told us to do. Look at Matthew 25, you know, and
exactly.
I was so impressed with that. I mean, here, this is his business, this is his livelihood, and there are plenty
yeah.
of people that are unemployed and don't have a record, and he went out of his way to seek these people out. This was 25 years ago, and
sure.
but I can see, obviously, employer hesitancy, especially right now when they got the pick of the litter. I mean, you know, it's like
right.
it's there's so many, you know, unfortunately, I guess jobs are hard to fill. But how do you convince an employer that this is in their best interest and society's best interest?
Right, right. We have a great employment specialist, Chris Marzan, who's mm-hmm. part of our staff,
right.
who works with reaching out to employers. A lot of the people we get into warehouse jobs to start, but also others are looking for reception jobs, or restaurants are hiring and having trouble filling spots. We do a lot of sort of role play with our clients on how to do interviews and when to share about your record and when not to share it and how much to, you know, what point do you sort of open up about that to both get the job but also to be honest and straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
But Chris is often working also with other organizations, CEO, ARI, La Familia, or some other organizations that also have employment placements. And some of them actually, there are federal and state contracts where the employer will get some money for the salary of the employee if
mm-hmm.
they hire a returning citizen. So that can be an incentive as well. And there can be tax breaks and other things like that for hiring returning citizens. But we've had a pretty good success rate of getting people into jobs.
That's remarkable. What are the legal requirements now in California in terms of disclosure, a job applicant disclosing
right.
incarceration?
Right. They're not allowed to ask on the application, But once they offer you the job, they can run a background check, uh-huh. and it will show up. So they can always rescind the job at that point if mm-hmm. they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, they can find out, but they can't ask right off at the beginning.
And so how do you advise your clients? Do you advise them to be upfront about it?
It's kind of a case-by-case basis. We mm-hmm. definitely tell them to be honest and certainly not to lie about it. With some of them, we might say, you know, don't bring it up right. We might suggest you not bring it up right at the beginning and let them offer you the job. And then when they offer it, it might be good to share at that point about what's been going on. And others, it's too obvious. There's a big break in their resume. And so we say, tell them just from the outset that this is what's happened and you made a mistake in your life and you were locked up for 9 months and now you're back. And, it also depends on the nature of the crime and whether that's going to impact, mm-hmm. you know, some employers, you know, won't hire anybody who's embezzled or
right.
or it's a driving job, so you can't have a DUI. So some of it's also trying to match up the offense with the right type of employment.
Are there certain crimes that you're not able to represent those people in this program?
We will work with most anyone. Our mm-hmm. housing, generally, we can't take sex offenders
right.
in our housing because of restrictions on right. housing and, yeah.
And the reporting requirements. Yeah, right.
Exactly. But we could still provide them a mentor. We could still help them with employment. We can. They're still human beings that we want to,
right.
you know, be compassionate towards. And, yeah.
So describe the training a little bit. Which is coming up.
The training is quite exciting. The next one is the second 2 weeks of August. It's a 4-session, 2 Thursday evenings and 2 Saturdays. A lot of it is actually run by and led by returning citizens, including ones that have men and women who have done up to one of them 35 years in prison.
Oh, wow.
Who share from their experience. And we do a lot of role plays and a lot of Q&A and a lot of discussion. We also do training specifically on working with addiction, on what resources are in the community, on trauma, since most everyone we work with has a trauma background. We do a lot of training on boundaries and what are the rules and the guidelines and the do's and don'ts, but also just how to keep healthy boundaries in our relationships, especially in our mentor-mentee relationship. And a real cohort forms of the group over the 18 hours, and then we continue support through ongoing phone calls and meetings and such, and then monthly check-ins as a group as they get their mentees and they start doing their work. So I think it's one of our real strengths is our training.
So it's not 18 hours all at once.
It's correct.
Not 6 a.m. to midnight.
No, it's over 2 weeks. Yeah.
Great. At three-hour sessions and 2 6-hour sessions.
Exactly. Right. And assuming things don't get much worse, we're going to go back in person for this one.
Boy, let's hope so.
We did the last two on Zoom, which worked out okay, too. But it'll be nice to be back in person, assuming.
And the mentor, in terms of, I guess I hate to use the term obligation, but a time obligation, if you will.
Sure, right. So after the training, we say it's about 6 to 8 hours per month
mm-hmm.
of working with the mentee and coming to our 1 hour a month meeting, and we ask for a 1 year commitment. Many of our mentors stay on much longer than that, but we ask for a 1 year commitment, and it's about 6 to 8 hours a month.
Will the mentee initially always be still incarcerated?
Not necessarily. Some people come to us through probation or parole or fat covered or rest care. We get referrals from all over. So we could match mentors with somebody who was already out, but we also match a lot of mentors with people who are still in and they'll start visiting at the jail.
Seth,
yeah, both are possible.
How can people sign up or even learn more about it?
Thank you. Yeah. So people can go to our website, exodus-project.org,
mm-hmm.
exodus-project.org. There's also a web page on the diocese website too. So you can go to the diocese website and just put in the search for Exodus. You can also call directly at 916-669-0612. That's 916-669-0612. And we're always happy to talk to men and women who want to be mentors. We match men with men and women with women, or people who want to make donations to support our work, or just hear more about what we're doing.
Very good, very good. Seth, people of your faith and people of our faith should know how to spell Exodus.
Exactly, exactly, yes.
Indeed. Well, it's always a joy to talk with you. Thanks so much for all you do, for doing the Lord's work, and we'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you, Bob. Always a pleasure.
God bless. Thanks so much, Seth. That's Seth Castleman, the director of Rabbi Seth Castleman, the director of the Exodus Project. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening. God bless everyone. We'd like to thank all the wonderful people and organizations, businesses in town, and throughout the Diocese of Sacramento, who have provided underwriting for the Bishop's Hour, some in the last few years, some have been with us for a very long time. If you would like to be an underwriter for the Bishop's Radio Hour, it's a wonderful opportunity to support this mission and also to support the diocese and also to get some recognition for your organization or for your business. The easiest way to do this is to give us a shout, send us an email, radio@scd.org, and we can give you all the details about helping to underwrite the Bishop's Radio Hour. Again, that's radio@scd.org. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the Mercy Foundation, enriching lives in the Sacramento region through Sisters of Mercy Ministries in healthcare, education, housing, and the care for the poor and elderly. For the Mercy Foundation, philanthropy is one of the most powerful expressions of compassion and love. Just as many people in our community need a hand, countless others are reaching out to them with comfort and hope. You can express your care and concern for the less fortunate with a gift to the Mercy Foundation. You can give them a call, 916-851-2700. That's 916-851-2700. And you can be confident that fully 100% of your contribution will support the Sisters of Ministry of Mercy Ministry or ministries that you choose. And what a wonderful treasure Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts has been for all of us here in the diocese as they transition into new ownership and management. They continue to offer wonderful workshops, wonderful resources for the Catholic community throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Not only does Easter's provide a wide array of Catholic books, both current releases and longtime classics, but they also sponsor a number of valuable workshops and lectures throughout the year. They're located at 6916 Sunrise Boulevard in Citrus Heights. Give them a call, 916-338-7272. We also receive a generous underwriting support by Crumley & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. If you have questions about retirement, Crumley & Associates can help you with their confident retirement approach that can help define a clear roadmap to get you where you want to go. You can contact them, get all the details at Crumley & Associates, 7956 California Avenue in Fair Oaks. They're at 916-638-4600. That's 916-638-4600. And we are certainly appreciative of the fine and long-standing support of the Mercy Foundation, of Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts, and of Crumley and Associates.
Well, here I am in a river of questions. Can I pour my heart out to a listening ear? But I see this life, its valleys and mountains, and I think of all the roads that brought me here. Oh, that brought me here. Walking down the road. Well, I've questioned my reasons,
this life I'm living, I questioned my ability to judge wrong from right. Well, I questioned all the things I've ever called certain, my race, my religion, my country, my mind.